Well, welcome to the second part of a series we're calling Didn't See It Coming. And if you were with us for the kickoff last weekend, you had the opportunity to get yourself and your household a free copy of Didn't See It Coming, and some of you are digging into it already. There are copies available at our locations this week, and all the proceeds go straight back into the mission of the church. We cover seven issues in the book. We're going to cover five on the weekend, and there's a lot more inside the book that we can then we can cover on a Sunday morning. But I'll tell you, it was off to a really fascinating start, even for me as the guy who wrote the book. There are a few things you shared with me that really surprised me. So we're talking about five issues in this series over five weekends of things we didn't see coming. Last week, we looked at cynicism. And the surprise for me, even after writing the book and sort of reflecting on it for years, was I never thought about it until last week, but I kind of thought cynicism was a guy issue. I just thought, well, men are cynical. And then I had all kinds of you come up to me last week and go, a lot of women, like, no, I'm really cynical too. I can't believe how cynical I am. Lots of messages, lots of feedback. It's not that I'm glad you're cynical, but I'm glad that we're diagnosing it at least and having a look at it. It seems to really hit all of us. And that's what we're talking about. All these things that, you know, nobody sets out to be cynical, nobody sets out to be proud or, you know, bitter or jaded, but it just happens. It sneaks up on us, and you find yourself at a place in life where you didn't really want to be, and you don't know how you got there, and you're thinking, okay, well, once a cynic, always a cynic? Like, is this just the way it is? And the answer, of course, is no. Fortunately, no. You don't have to stay a cynic, and every week we want to talk about how to get into the problems that we get ourselves into. So last week, part one was cynicism. Next week, we're going to come back, we're going to talk about pride, and surprise, surprise, it's not just the narcissists. I mean, we live in a pretty narcissistic age, but a lot of us struggle with pride in a very surprising area. It even comes up with those of us who would say, hey, I'm insecure. Then we're going to cover emptiness, something that really we don't talk a lot about in the church. We don't talk a lot about in the culture. We just say succeed, 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 but a lot of successful people feel empty. Why is that? Fortunately, Jesus talked a lot about that. We're going to wrap up the series with burnout, but today we're going to talk about disconnection. And we're going to try to wade into this paradox that I think a lot of us feel in the age we're living in right now. If you want to define our culture, see whether this doesn't resonate with you, that we've never been more connected as a culture, and yet we've never felt more alone. It's so strange. We're 10 years now into the era of smartphones, and we live in a constantly connected environment. Average person has 500 friends on social media. So we've never really been able to connect with more people. You can text your kids any time of the day or night. You can keep up with what's going on. You know things you probably don't even want to know, but we're so connected. You figured that out. And yet, sociologists, scientists, people in the medical profession are growing increasingly alarmed at this sense of isolation and aloneness that we feel. And if you were to really look inside, and I hope you do today, whether you call yourself a Christian, you don't consider yourself a Christian, whether you're just tuning in, whatever your story happens to be, do you feel more connected than you did a decade ago or less? And I think if you talk to a lot of people, they're like, yeah, it's this weird thing. Like, I know I'm connected to so many people, but I feel so alone. And you might even be in the room today and you're surrounded by lots of people, but you're like, I feel all alone. I feel lonely. Some of you, you're watching online right now and you're only a couple of miles away, but you're like, no, I prefer to be alone. There is something that's forcing us into our own spaces and our own places, and we seem to be withdrawing. We're desperately trying to connect, but we're not really succeeding. In fact, there was some research done recently, just some polls. 50% of people surveyed say they always or sometimes feel alone or left out. This is according to the Sigma Insurance study, which was obviously they have a vested interest in this. This was a massive study of over 2,000 individuals in North America. 50% of people say they always or sometimes feel alone or left out. You ever scroll through your social feed and go like, how come everybody else is having a great life and I'm not? Like, why do I feel so left out? Why do I feel like all this is passing me by? You're with half the people. 54% of people say no one knows them really well. Now, that includes married people. Some of you, you've been married for a couple of years, 10 years, 15 years, more than that. But you say to yourself, you haven't even articulated it, but it's like, you know what? My wife doesn't really know me. My husband doesn't really know me. Nobody really knows me. Over half the population says nobody really knows them well. And yet one of the deepest human needs we have is to be known, for someone to say, hey, I matter, I'm significant, I matter. 40% of people say their relationships aren't meaningful. And again, this includes married people. So it's like your friendships, your work relationships, your relationships with your extended family, your immediate family, not really meaningful, almost half. And then in another study, they broke things down by age. So I want to show you this graph. There's a scale developed, I think it was at UCLA, called a loneliness scale. And it doesn't go from 0 to 100, it goes from 20 to 80. So if you're 80, you're profoundly lonely, like almost solitary confinement. If you're 20, you're not very lonely at all, you're hyperconnected. All right, Generation Z, which is basically people between about the age of 10 and early 20s, depending on where you cut it off, but maybe 21, 22. Gen Z rates at a 48.6 on the loneliness scale, which is actually hyper lonely. When you look at it, it only goes from 20 to 80, the most isolated generation. Millennials come in just below that at 45.3 on the loneliness score. Baby boomers, a little bit less, 42.4 on the loneliness score. And then elderly, 72 plus, they come in at 38.6 on the loneliness score. Now, I didn't make up this survey, but what really amazed me is anybody else Generation X? Like, that's me. Yeah, okay, three of us. That's why. We're not even on the chart. Nobody studied us. That's a story of our generation. It's like, I don't know why, we don't count, but if you're Generation X, you're just random and nobody cares about you. So anyway, I don't know where we rank, but Generation Z, Millennials, Baby Boomers, you know what's weird? Look at this, the older you are, the more connected you are and the less lonely you feel, which is also weird because you may have noticed in the news in early 2018 in the United Kingdom, they actually appointed a cabinet position, a minister for loneliness, not a minister of loneliness. Go sit in the corner all by yourself, all right? But a minister for loneliness, because they're concerned in the United Kingdom, like many people are growingly concerned, that isolation is an epidemic. And there's an actual stat, I couldn't believe this when I read it, that there's over 200,000 senior adults in the United Kingdom who have not connected in person with a single other human being in the last 30 days. And they're the least lonely generation, according to this. So here's what's paradoxical. 95% of Generation Z is on YouTube and social daily. And obviously that figure isn't as high with seniors. So the more connected you are, the more lonely you feel. Strange. And the question I want to ask today is, well, what's going on? What is actually going on? And a lot of us would say, I'll tell you what the problem is, Carrie. Everything was simpler before we had technology. And I want to suggest to you that that isn't the case. It's not a technology problem. Now, it's not just a technology problem. Has technology made it worse? Well, maybe. I mean, how many times you go into a restaurant now, you see a couple who are on a date and none of them are talking to each other. They're all on their phones. And some of us have had those dates. So it can be a technology problem, but I want to suggest to you, it is not just a technology problem. It's a human problem. It's a human problem. That my propensity to disconnect predates a smartphone. I'm like, my disposition toward disconnecting from other human beings goes way back to my childhood. And I want those of you who remember the dial-up days. Anyone remember the dial-up days? Yeah, yeah. Remember how hard it was to get online and how excited you were to get email? It's like, whoo, I got 4 today. Now you get 400 and you hate it. But anyway, you know, it's a different age. But if you think back to those days, like even, you know, my childhood in the 1970s was really interesting because we had this thing called landlines, okay? Where a phone actually had a wire, it was plugged into a wall. And sometimes, talk about the propensity to disconnect, parents would actually get so frustrated with their teenagers tying up the phone that they would put in a teenager line. And if you looked in the phone book, there was actually like, you know, Newhoff and then teenager phone beside a separate phone number. And often, sometimes it was guys, but I think it was mostly sisters. Sister would be in her room all night long talking on the phone for hours with friends. For some of you, it was MSN Messenger when you were growing up in high school or whatever it happened to be. But you think about it, even before that, some of us grew up with dads. Dad would come home from work, and every night right after dinner, he would disappear into the garage and work on his 68 Camaro, which was never finished because he didn't want it to be finished, right? He didn't want it. He just didn't want to deal with the family. He didn't want to deal with the homework. Like, and if you think this is a technology problem and you've never read the Bible, I want you to go back. It's not hard. I want you to go 2 pages in to Genesis chapter 3. Genesis is the first book. You will find this very easily. Flip over the page, find Genesis 3, start reading, and you will realize that fear and hiding and isolation and shame go back to the very beginning of humanity. That we've just disconnected, that the challenge for all of us who are married, the challenge for parents and children, the challenge for siblings, the challenge for friends is when something goes wrong, we hide, we disconnect. It's a human problem. Now, what about technology? Does that make it more difficult? Sure. But what I've said consistently over the years is technology isn't good or evil. It just reveals and amplifies what's already there. So think about paper, for example. Is paper good or is paper evil? Well, paper can be incredible. I mean, I believe the words of the Bible are life-giving, and the Bible gets written on paper. The most beautiful poetry ever written gets printed on paper. Paper can house some of the greatest art in the world, and it can be used by an arsonist to burn down a house. And it can be used for humanly degrading pornography. So is paper good or is paper evil? Well, paper isn't really good or evil. Paper is just paper. It just shows what's in your heart. And sometimes it's good and sometimes it's terrible. And technology is the same way. Now, it probably makes it easier to do bad, but it also makes it easier to do good. And so all that stuff, does Facebook break up marriages? Facebook is cited in a meaningful percentage of divorces today. Facebook killed my marriage. Facebook didn't kill your marriage. You killed your marriage. You just made it easy. It might have made it easier to connect with that person you had a crush on in high school, but you sent the message. Facebook didn't send the message. Snapchat didn't send the message or those pictures. All right? It's not just a technology problem. It's a human problem. Now, I'm going to do what it's going to seem like a totally different message. You're like, woo, we're in some other week or whatever. It is more connected than you think. But I want to take you down a road that seems like a rabbit trail. I hope you don't think it is by the time we're done. But I think in our culture, we've lived through 2 premature deaths. Like literally in your lifetime, we're watching 2 things die before our eyes. Things that were more alive a decade ago, 20 years ago than they are today. Number one, the death of conversation. That conversation is actually a dying art. In a good conversation, it's a tennis match, all right? A good conversation is, hey, how are you doing? Oh, I'm doing okay. How are you doing? Not bad. Volley back to me. Then I ask you a question. Then you know, and these can be 5-minute answers or 3-minute answers, but a good conversation goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And I've noticed, and I started talking about this with my wife, Toni, and then we started asking a few friends, and I've asked pretty widely about it. I find a lot of conversations are one-sided these days. That it's just a stream of consciousness. You talk to somebody, and it's almost like they're posting a social media update, except they're doing it in person, and it's just a monologue, and they don't ask questions back. I noticed this, I was writing the book last summer, I went on a trip, I was at a conference, a leadership conference, and this guy had reached out to me and he said, hey, I want to meet with you. And I'm like, okay, great. I got questions to ask you. I'm like, awesome. So I decided to meet with him. We went outside and started to connect. So I just asked him a question and I noticed he was just talking and talking and talking and talking. And I thought, oh my gosh, like I was already thinking about the death of conversation. And I thought, what do I do? So I thought, you know, I'm going to time this. So, you know, I got nothing else to do. I don't have anything to say. So I'm like, I'm going to time it. 28 minutes. I didn't say a word. 28 minutes and 3 seconds. It was incredible, you know? But that's not what a conversation is supposed to be. A conversation is supposed to be mutual. Now, I don't know if that's social media that's just teaching us to share what's on our mind and make it about me, 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 but genuine conversation is rare. And it's dying. When I first got here and the churches were really, really small, we talked about that last week, I used to go visit people in their homes. You know, we had a lot of elderly people and some of them couldn't make it to church anymore. So I'd go to the condo or the apartment. And I was pretty nervous because I'd never thought I'd be a pastor and nobody really trained you for that. It's like, how do you do a home visit? And I realized with people who live alone and who are shut in and who are elderly, wasn't that hard. All I did was I walked in, I said, hello. And an hour later, they were done. You know, I didn't say a word. It was just, but that's what happens when you live by yourself and you're isolated and you don't talk to people. It's like, thank goodness, another human being. Maybe the death of conversation in our culture is related to the fact that we all feel alone. And so when we see another human being, it's like, you know, 40-minute monologue. Anyway, preacher. Anyway, the death of conversation. And then there's the death of confession, the death of confession. And I think the two are related to the way we feel. Now, what is confession? If you're raised Roman Catholic, you go into a little booth, there's a guy with a collar on the other side, and you tell all the bad things you did, and then hopefully you never do them again, and the next time you do them, you go back and see the guy in the booth. If you're raised in our tradition, what do you do about confession? If you do it, because we don't really do a lot of confession in the church anymore, because we live in a culture where nobody's responsible for anything. Hey, that is not my fault. That's the school system, man. That's work. That's my boss. That's my ex. Though that was my parents, that's not me. Hey, it's the economy, it's not me. Hey, it's not fair, that's life. I'm not responsible for anything, I'm a victim. So we don't have anything to confess because there's nothing wrong with me. And even in the church, if we do confess anything, how do you do it? I'll tell you how I was taught to do it in the church I grew up in. You do that privately, by yourself, in your room, when you pray, and you don't talk to anybody about it. And when was the last time you heard somebody say, you know what? I did it, and I'm responsible, and I'm sorry. When I did that, I hurt your feelings. When I said that, it was inappropriate. When I behaved that way in the meeting, I blew up the room. I'm sorry. Confession's dying in the church and in the culture. And so we have these two things, no more real conversation, or it's very rare. I'll tell you, Tony, my wife and I, when we come back and we've had a real life-giving conversation, it's amazing, but it's rare. And confession seems to be dying. So how's this all related? Again, we're doing the hard turn. How's this related to being isolated and lonely and all this? James chapter 5. So James is Jesus' brother, a half-brother, and he's writing to Christians trying to figure out what it means to be together. Now, if you're raised in the church, like hardcore raised in the church, you pray, all that kind of stuff, you might recognize this passage. For the rest of us, just come along for the ride. This is interesting because he makes these claims, and this is all connected. You'll see it in a minute. Are any of you suffering hardships? You should pray. Are any of you happy? You should sing praises. And then he asks this question, and this is what we talk about. If you're really into prayer, if you pray a lot, you probably know this verse. Are any of you sick? Because then he says what you should do is pray about it, okay? But are any of you sick? Now, when you see the word sick in English, what do you think of? You think of, do any of you have a medical condition? Have any of you been diagnosed with something? Are you not feeling well? That headache that won't go away, or you know, that cancer that you just got, or how about that broken leg that isn't healing, or whatever it happens to be, are any of you sick? Now, of course, the Bible wasn't written in English, it was written in Greek, and so sometimes words have a hard time being translated. When you actually look at the word for sick, as it appears in the Greek, it is not just about a medical condition. In fact, I think you can argue it is principally not about a medical condition. It's really answering the question like, how are you? Are any of you, maybe you could put in the word struggling. Any of you really wrestling with what's going on at work? Any of you having trouble in your marriage right now? Any of you really frustrated with your kids right now? Any of you in some kind of addiction? Any of you struggling like with your mental health or how you're feeling? Any of you really in a bad place? That's what's under the word sick. It's not like a medical condition and here's your prescription. It's really like, how's it going for real? Any of you troubled? Any of you frustrated? Any of you just angry all the time? Any of you addicted to stuff? Yeah? Well, you should call for the elders of the church to come and pray over you, anointing you with oil in the name of the Lord. Now, remember, back then, churches were really small. They were house churches. So you get to a church our size, 3,000-4,000 people, call our church home. What do? Well, we only have 5 elders. They can't go to everyone's house. So we actually do small group. And you heard your host today talk about that at your campus or if you're watching online. We want you to get into a small group because this is how we do it. And hundreds of people are in groups. And you can pray about this stuff. You can pray about what's going on in your life. You can pray about what you're struggling with. And then James makes this incredible claim. Such a prayer offered in faith will heal the sick and the Lord will make you well. So you got like issues at work, you're fighting at home all the time, you hate your kids or they hate you or what's going on? A prayer offered in faith will heal that. You got to get it out because you're so isolated. You're so alone. You're so all by yourself. You got to get this stuff out. And if you, then he goes, this is like, where are you going? And if you've committed any sins, you will be forgiven. It's like, whoa, how did you bring sin into this? Then he says this, community, all of you who are together, confess your sins to each other and pray for each other so that you may be healed. Now, again, I know a lot of you didn't grow up in church. I get that. But if you grew up in church, when was the last time you confessed your sins to somebody else? In our tradition, you don't do that. That's private. That's between you and God. No, it's not. No, it's not. We're supposed to talk about this stuff. I do some speaking on the road at conferences and events. And last October, I was at an event in Memphis. And, you know, it's a plane ride down and then taxi over and hotel and all that stuff. So I got to the airport in Toronto and they had free cookies in the lounge. So I'm like, oh, free cookies. I'll have a cookie. So I had a cookie and then I got on the plane and I had a meal and they had dessert. So I had dessert. And then I got to the speaking event. And they had, you know, sometimes with speakers, they have a green room and then they serve you with all the other speakers and the volunteers and all that stuff. And this was in Tennessee. They had barbecue. And I mean, that was incredible. That's not a sin. They have barbecue. So I was pretty excited about getting Southern barbecue. But then they had like banana pudding. And if you've ever had banana pudding made in the South by people who do barbecue, that is like, they're serving that in heaven, I promise you. So it's like, well, I gotta have some banana pudding. And then I was getting ready to speak. They had M&Ms in the green room, you know, for speakers, just as you get. So it's like, well, I'll have a few M&Ms. And then my buddy was in town from Atlanta. So we went out after just to catch up. And he's not really a dessert guy, but he's like, you wanna get dessert? I'm like, well, Frank's gonna have dessert. I guess I'll get dessert. So anyway, I got dessert. I got back to the hotel room and I counted it up and I'm like, I had 5 desserts today. I ate dessert 5 times and I was just shocked. And, you know, in my head, I'm trying to lose weight. And so, you know, the two do not add up. So I'm like, what do I do with this? And I know these guys at this conference. So the next day I go and I start telling my friends, I'm like, do you know how many desserts I ate yesterday? I had 5. So I said it out loud and then I put myself on a sugar fast. And I'm like, no more sugar, no more dessert. And so I kept that up for months. The first few days were brutal. Of course, what do they bring into the speaker's room for lunch the next day? Giant cookies. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh no, don't. But you know what? I had to confess my sin. And it's one thing to know secretly that you ate 5 cookies or desserts. It's another thing to say to people that you respect, guess how much dessert I had yesterday? I had 5 desserts. It's embarrassing, right? So what do you need to confess? I drink every day. By the way, that's not me. So if you're wondering, you know, no church crisis. But what is it? Like I drink every day or every Friday night. I smoke weed. And lately, you know what? It's almost every day when I get home from work. Or we scream a lot in our house and I'm responsible for that. Or my kids drive me crazy and I yell at them a lot. Or my porn problem is out of control. See, it's one thing to know that you have an issue. It's another thing, and it's one thing to bring it to God. God, I don't know what to do about this porn thing, or I eat too much dessert, or I drink every day, or I can't remember last time I didn't have a drink, or I'm so sorry I lost my temper. It's one thing to tell God, and he's like, yeah, but you didn't lose your temper at me. You lost your temper with your wife. And you can tell your wife, I'm sorry I lost my temper. But what if you told someone else? I lost my temper 7 times yesterday with my family. Here's how much I drank at the party. I can't remember the last time I didn't have a drink. See, you'll start to make progress if you start to confess your sins out loud. Confess your sins to each other, because it's embarrassing when you admit who you really are. And pray for each other, so that you may be healed. You know where Tony and I have experienced that over the years? In many forums, but one of the principal ones is in our small group. And for those of you who aren't in a group, you need to get in a group. I'll talk about burnout in the final week of the series, but you know, one of the things God used to get me through my burnout was our small group. And our marriage wasn't at its finest at that time either. And you know what? Our small group knew. Tony and I will talk about that in a separate series this fall about the struggles we've had in our marriage. But when you gotta tell your group, hey, I'm struggling here, and they rally around and they pray for you and they support you and they love you and they don't judge you and you get it out, you get healed. And James knew that. And you're doing this in the context of community. Because when you're all by yourself in your little room and you just tell God, if you even tell God or you don't tell anybody, you don't get better. You don't get better. The earnest prayer of a righteous person has great power and produces wonderful results. Christ is righteous. And when the community gathers broken people like me and broken people like you, and we tell each other what we're struggling with, and we're honest with each other, our marriages get better, work gets better, we get better, we feel better. So if you haven't registered for GroupLink, do it. And there's dessert, too, at group. So you need to know that. So what should we do this week? I want to encourage you to do a couple things. Number one, connect. Connect. Because we're the most isolated generation, I think probably in history. The most connected, the most alone. Connect. And confess. Confess. Just like you gotta get it off your chest and you know. Just be honest about who you are. Yeah, I can't remember the last time I haven't had a drink. Yeah, I had 8 at the party. Yeah, I screamed at my kids and at my wife yesterday. Yeah, the porn problem's gotten worse. I'm just angry at the world. I'm angry at the people I work with. I don't know what to do about it. See, solitude is a gift from God. I start every day with solitude. I do pray by myself. I start my day usually before the sun rises. I open up the Bible. I pray. I love solitude. The older I get, the more life-giving solitude is. Solitude's a gift. Isolation is a tool of the enemy. Isolation, and he's like, oh, we got you alone. We'll pick you off. You're outnumbered. You don't stand a chance. Isolation's a tool of the enemy, and here we are with the illusion of connectedness, more isolated than we've ever been. So this week, disconnect to reconnect. Disconnect to reconnect. So I want to share a couple of things that you can try. One thing you can do to foster the art of conversation is listen. Listen. Be a listener rather than like, because you know what I'm doing if I'm not careful? I'm formulating what I'm going to say in response to what you just said so that I can get my point across or I can get, just listen, listen. And this is what you'll discover. If you listen longer than most people listen, you'll hear things most people never hear. So a few years ago, I launched a leadership podcast that I do, and I was a few episodes into it. It's a long-form interview format, lasts about anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour and a half each episode. And I just interview really interesting top leaders. Sometimes we post some of the interviews on the Kinexus podcast feed, so you may be familiar with it. And we're five episodes into it, and I'm driving around with my wife. We're listening back to an episode, and I said, so you have any feedback? And she goes, yeah, you talk too much. I'm like, okay. Thanks. And I said, what do you mean? She says, you're always interjecting and you've always got your opinion. And you know what? I took that to heart. And I've spent the last few years trying to shut up. And it's amazing what happens. So it's an audio podcast, but I do the interviews either by video or in person because I think you get a better interview if you can see them. So I can see them, they can see me. And lately what I've been doing, in addition to shutting up, is I'll let leaders talk, and some of them get interviewed all the time, so they're used to it. And I'll just let them, you know, talk and talk and talk, and then they'll be finished. I can tell by their body language that they're finished. And then what I'll do is I won't say anything. I'll give them a little nod, and then I'll just be quiet. And then they're kind of like, oh, okay. And then they start up for like round two, and that's where the gold is. Because you've talked past the soundbite. And I'm getting texts from people who have been, some of these people lead very large organizations. I'm getting texts from people who are on their team going, I've worked with this leader for 15 years. We've never heard him talk about this. It's like, all you have to do is shut up. And they'll talk to you. And if you listen longer than most people listen, you'll start to hear things most people never hear. You don't really know your spouse? Listen. You don't really know your kids? Shut up. And listen. But most of us are in a hurry. Another way to disconnect, to reconnect, is to slow down because love has a speed. Love has a speed. And I'm very driven. I'm very entrepreneurial. I'm very ambitious. I'm an early riser. I got a huge to-do list. Like, I'm just that way. I'm very driven. Love has a speed. And guess what? It's slower than I am. And love has a speed, and it's slower than you are. The speed of love is very slow. Dallas Willard, an amazing thinker, writer on spiritual formation, was talking to John Ortberg one day, another brilliant guy. And John said, what do I need to do to really connect with God? And Dallas said this. He said, you must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. And John says Dallas did. Dallas died a few years ago, but John says, if you went to Dallas's house, the phone could be ringing off the hook. Dallas didn't even notice. You were the only person in the world and the only person in the room. So here's another thing you can do to ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. Just unplug meaningful parts of your life, kind of like Little House on the Prairie. So anyone remember Little House on the Prairie? It was around when I was a kid. I never liked it when I was a kid. My sisters liked the show, so I didn't like it automatically. But anyway, it was Little House on the Prairie. Anyway, last summer, I was like, you know, I'd been working on the book, working on messages. I'm like, I got to take a break. And I was taking the break just by scrolling through, I don't know, iTunes or Netflix or whatever. And I come across Little House on the Prairie. I'm like, huh, there's something I haven't seen since I was a kid. And on impulse, I bought the entire series. Like, just like, boom, you know? It's like, why did I just do that? I don't know. And I thought, I'm going to look at the pilot. So I watched this two-hour pilot, and it was interesting. So Little House on the Prairie was shot in the 1970s. So it's 40 years old already. So it's shot in the 1970s, but it's describing life in the 1870s, homesteading in Minnesota. So I'm watching this pilot, and it is slow. Like peanut butter and molasses had a baby slow. All right? There's no plot. There's nothing going on in this episode. I couldn't believe it. You know, you watch TV today, you watch movies, it's like action movies, a car blows up every 3 seconds, people are jumping off walls, you know, there's jump shots and reaction shots. Little House on the Prairie, awkward. It just, all the shots last forever. It was incredible. There's no plot. It's like, we had a squirrel come to the house today. 2 hours later, you know? Oh my gosh. And camera shots that lasted 15, 20 seconds. Like, no, the actors are done their lines, but the camera's still on them. And I'm like, wow. And you know what occurred to me? Things have changed in 40 years. A lot. A lot. Things have changed in 140 years, and things have changed in the 40 years since that was shot. Love has a speed. It's slower than you are. And it's slower than I am. And love pauses. Love lingers. Love offers full focus and gives far more than it takes. So one or two of the things that I do, and I'm technology guy. I'm up at 3 o'clock in the morning ordering whatever just got released that day. I'm that person. But you know, my phone, I'll just show you. It's been on Do Not Disturb for about 2 years now. That's that little moon that comes on your phone. It's just on all the time. Because I found my life is busy enough that when I have my phone in my pocket, it's just gonna be buzzing and chirping and ringing, and I've got a smartwatch, so it's gonna be buzzing on my wrist like literally twice a minute. And when that's happening, I can't focus on you, I can't focus on my wife, my kids, or anybody in my life. So my phone's just on Do Not Disturb all the time. And what that means is I miss all of my text messages and my phone calls, and so what? If it's really important, I know it's coming in, I'll turn it off, but then I leave it on. And you know, if the house is really burning down, I'm sure somebody will knock on my door and tell me. It's not the end of the world. And I'm ADD enough to look at my phone every half hour anyway and see what I missed. We had, even long before technology and smartphones, Tony and I, my wife and I, we made a decision early on when we started out that our living room was gonna be technology free, that we weren't gonna have, we'll have music, but we're not gonna have a TV. We're not gonna have a TV in the kitchen because we wanted dinner to be about family and conversations. And even in the busiest of seasons, we'd have dinner together 5 nights a week around the table. And we didn't want TVs to take us away. We decided early on that in our bedroom, there'd be no TV. You know, you'd think we'd have 17 kids, but we don't, we just have two. Because we wanted to make our bedroom about relationship and about connecting. Even in our cars, you know, we didn't have like DVDs built into the entertainment system because we decided even before tablets, like we want cars to be about conversations. So our kids never had iPads in the back seat. They never had, you know, now I've got a car because it just came with it, but our kids are grown now with a DVD in it. I don't even know how to work it. Who cares? But cars were about conversation and dinner was about conversation. Because I even knew, as bad as I am at this, that love pauses and love lingers and love offers full focus and it gives far more than it takes. And this is what I think you'll find if you disconnect to reconnect, that in the process of connecting with others, you might finally connect with God and you might even connect with yourself. But you need to slow down and confess and have a conversation and connect. Because love has a speed and it's slower than you are. Now I know in 3 or 4 minutes you're gonna be out in the foyers or you're gonna be turning this thing off and back into your busy life and you're gonna forget all this. So the way we're gonna close today is we're gonna close really quietly. And I just want you to take some time to reflect before we go and the chaos starts again on how you can slow down and how you can disconnect this week to reconnect. So I want you to think about that and we'll get started by praying. God, we need to connect with you and we have so much to confess, so much we struggle with. We're so busy. We don't hear from anybody, not even ourselves. So help us to disconnect, to move at the speed of love. We which is slow. So I pray you'd lead us in this time together. In Jesus' name, amen.